Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Quality sleep optimizes recovery, helping professional and everyday athletes perform their best. Only the Sleep Number Smart Bed is proven to improve the quality of sleep and provides valuable insights that can be used to support overall wellness. Talent on a college team allows the best players to outperform their opponents, but in the NFL, everyone is talented. Players entering the draft need every competitive edge they can get, starting with quality sleep. Training will only get more intense as players transition to the pros, so to optimize recovery, they can rely on Sleep Number for consistent, high-quality sleep. Experience game-changing sleep with a Sleep Number smart bed only at a Sleep Number store.
All right, you guys are on.
You done being disgusting, Connor?
Yes.
Okay. This week's episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by our friends at Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club is the best way to shave if you're going to shave. I can't believe that we have so many military members that don't use Dollar Shave Club because you're required to shave every single day if you have unless you have like a no shave chick because you're a nasty motherfucker. I would have used Dollar Shave Club without a doubt if I was still in the military and if I was a shaving guy like my pal Brendan here and my pal Connor. They should have Dollar Shave Club. I know both of those guys do. If you're like me and sick of the nonsense at the store, now's the time to try out Dollar Shave Club for a limited time. Dollar Shave Club is basically giving away their shit shower and shave set to new members. For only $5, this starter set features their executive razor, a 3-trial size version of their most popular products that helps you stay fresh and clean. In your first box, you'll receive a shave butter, body wash, one white butt Charlie's, and you'll also receive the executive razor, which includes their premium weighty handle, a full cassette of cartridges, and after the first box, replacement cartridges are sent for only a few bucks a month. This offer is exclusively available at dollarshaveclub.com/chaps. That's dollarshaveclub.com/CHAPS. And if you want a great gift, give them Dollar Shave Club. There's only a simple gift, and e-gift cards are available. So if you want to give somebody a last-minute gift that'll last them the full year, get dollarshaveclub.com before Christmas. It's Friday. You're slacking because there's only 2 days before Christmas if you're listening to this on Friday. Get some Dollar Shave Club. Shave your nasty mug, you nasty motherfuckers. Let's go.
We are doing well. We had ourselves a little bit of an evening last night. We had the company Christmas party, and it was quite the scene. And happy to see that everybody made it in this morning. And I don't know that...
Mandatory fun is a little bit different in the Barstool Network than it is in the military environment. I feel like everybody actually has a good time. There's nobody disgruntled to be at one of the fancy boy bars that you guys went to last night.
Yeah, no one's like, ah, shoot, we got to go to that party tonight. It's actually, there's a palpable excitement that is permeating throughout the building, and it was a good time.
I'm waiting on pins and needles to see the exact receipt from the bar tab.
It was quite fantastic. So we got to give a shout out to our guy, Brett, who took care of everything and set us up real nice. So office manager Brett did a great job.
Hell yeah. I watched Love Actually last night, and it was absolutely wonderful. Me and my wife sent the kiddies to bed a little bit early. So we were watching it, and she had DVR'd the movie, and it played like the edited version, which the edited version of Love Actually is trash. Like, there's not a lot of movies that you're like, I will not watch the edited version that comes on regular TV.
Right.
But we had that DVR'd, and I missed hearing these parts. So whenever the first scene comes up, and that part is not like cussing and not the dude being Britishly vulgar, which is an incredible sense to be vulgar. The British version of vulgarity is much better than the American version. It's one of the only things that they do better than us is cuss and swear at each other.
Right.
I love that part. So when that part was lacking, I was like, nope, we're going. I'm actually going to rent this movie. And she was like, just see how much it is. $3.99. I smashed it. She was like, what are you doing? And I was
like,
we're not
children.
Poor. Like, we can watch a $3.99 movie.
Yeah, you're not an E2 anymore.
Oh, I just goodness. Get so sick of fast forward. And the shocking part was the channel that we downloaded from, whenever it was on the downloaded TV, the DVR version, it was 3 hours and 20 minute long movie.
Oh.
When we actually downloaded the movie, like on Amazon, it was 2 hours and 12 minutes.
Is it really
like it
that
added
long
an
of a movie?
Additional hour?
Oh, with all the commercials, yeah, sure. I didn't realize. I guess I didn't remember that it was that long of a movie. But it's a fantastic one. What are some other ones that you got in your top Christmas movies?
Ooh, Elf is probably
Elf is awesome.
Surpassed everything for me. I think Elf is now my favorite Christmas movie of all time. I think, and I was talking to my wife about this the other day. We were hanging out with the kids. I think not only is Home Alone 2 the best overall Christmas movie, I think the scene where Kevin is throwing the bricks off and hitting him in the face, I think that is it's a top five funny movie scene of all time.
It's just I can't stop laughing when he's chucking those bricks and they're just hitting him square in the face. You're absolutely right. It is just laugh out loud funny stuff. It's unbelievable.
If you like slapstick humor, yeah. Like that's it's top notch. Because when he's laying on the ground after getting smacked with, like, five rings, it kills me. I've seen it probably 100 times, and yeah. It still kills me. McCartney absolutely loves it. Kelsey loves it. My wife looks at all of us like she's like, you guys are screaming, laughing like psychopaths. That's one of my favorite Christmas movies.
Yeah.
For sure.
The Home Alones are up there. Elf is up there. I'm a sucker for the old ones. I like It's a Wonderful Life. I'm over It's a Christmas.
It's a Wonderful Life stinks.
All right.
And
I disagree.
Stinks. I think there's like two or three good scenes in A Christmas Story. Ralphie eating the mashed potatoes, or whatever the fucking little kid's name is, eating the mashed potatoes. That always gets a chuckle. The soap in the mouth scene is a good one, and Shoot Your Eye Out. And when he actually goes ham and beats the shit out of the other kids, I like
that
bully, too.
Yes. But, I won't stand here, or excuse me, I won't sit here and let you slander my love for It's a Wonderful Life when George Bailey realizes that he really has it all. And that's an amazing time in cinema.
Yeah, when people start filing in to give him money,
yeah,
it's tearjerker.
Yeah. Yeah. And when
trash.
You know, when the bell rings and the angel gets its wings, come on, every time.
Trash.
Every
Again,
time.
Angels are trash in general.
That's I don't know if that's very nice to say during the Christmas season.
The Muppets, A Christmas Carol, underrated Christmas movie.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not a big fan of the Muppets.
I've never seen it. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Oh, you need to see it. Report back. That's a good one.
Let's kill. Hold on, Pete Brain. We got busted last time because we underestimated that little bundle of misery.
2 hours later.
Okay, you promise? I cross my heart and hope to die. Okay.
All right, we don't need to replay the whole scene. Jesus Christ! Cut that, Brendan. It's like 3 minutes after we talked about it.
Oh man, that's just such a great scene. They just suck bricks. Oh, it's fantastic.
That was a ridiculous time to put that in 3 minutes after we actually talked about the scene.
We're having fun here for the Christmas holiday.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that happened this week. I wanted to get back into a couple weeks ago whenever they had the bombing. And it wasn't even really a bombing. It was kind of like an attempted bombing that went a little bit awry.
The worst bombing of all time. Like, that guy stinks.
Yeah, the worst bomber of all time. Tried to strap a pipe bomb to his chest. And didn't really do a whole lot.
I mean, the fact that he didn't even die himself, like he was barely injured. You got to really think about
that's gotta
how much
super,
you suck.
That's got to be super, super insulting. Yeah. Like, you think that you're like half a step away from 40 virgins, and then you're like, well, now I'm in jail for the rest of my life.
And instead of 40 virgins, you got 40 dudes up at Rikers coming for that ass.
See, I think that Connor, stop drinking fucking water! It's
sorry.
So loud.
All right, I'm sorry.
Connor's radio coup today is out of control. He walks in because he's hungover wearing glasses like an animal. And then he's chewing gum loud as fuck, crinkling in his water, doing 3-minute long videotapes that are like 2 minutes behind. What are you doing, Cons? Act like we've done 70 fucking shows together.
All right. I'll get myself together.
Christ,
I apologize.
I think God's still drunk from last night, probably.
All right. Are we going to start this episode now?
Connor's a professional podcast host, one of the best military podcasts in the world. Act like he's never been on the radio. Jesus. So anyways, the kid's a the bomber's a fuck up, completely a fuck up. But my boy that I was excited about when I read it, I actually didn't even notice because I'm so over like reading about bombers and reading the names of the people and these background informations. Mm-hmm. And I actually think I don't know if you guys saw it or not, but this week the Institute for Crime that does like criminology and reports on crime, they give statistics to the FBI and a lot of other law enforcement branches. They said one of the best ways to curtail all of these bombings was stop making the people famous. Because they do, man.
Right,
they, like,
yeah.
Make these people like...
I mean, they go in-depth...
Like the criminal version of the Kardashians.
Absolutely. They go in-depth with the background and their story and who they are and what their purpose was. It's absolutely unreal. You're right. They should just say terrorist or, you know, person X, something. But they shouldn't go in-depth as much as they do. You're absolutely right.
It should... You know, like the rules whenever there's a sexual assault victim and they don't release anything about the sexual assault victim, like gender, they don't release names, they don't release location, they don't release anything like that. Mm-hmm. They should have those same journalistic standards for somebody who creates mass hysteria. Mm-hmm. Like, and because you can't, terrorism people come in and be like, hey, terrorism actually political religious affiliation and like whatever. Mass hysteria. If they cause mass hysteria, mass violence. Have those same sexual assault standards in journalism because that's not the important part. The important part are the people who are the victims, and you shouldn't get any fame
right.
from it.
It
there
perpetuates,
should not be allowed to be
a... You're right. It perpetuates the terrorism when they continue to talk about them. So they should...
Now, if you want to give like to the first responders, I think that's great. And I wanted to talk about it a little bit because I want to give a shout-out to one of my former Marines, Anthony Manfredini, who was one of the first responders. He was a canine guy in the Marine Corps. This dude, I'll give him a little credit. I don't know him very personally, like on a personal level, like where I mentored him or anything, but he was in my company when I was a company gunnery sergeant. He came through school whenever I taught at the school. I was always impressed with him from afar. There's not many kids or not many junior Marines who come in and say, all right, I am a military police officer, but I want to take it the next step. I want to go to SWAT school. So he came in, did everything that he needed to do to go to SRT, the Swift Response Team. He did everything that he needed to do. He did that, like went through. Within his first year of being in the Marine Corps, he was through MP school, through SRT school, and then a year and a half later, he decided he wanted to do canine because he wanted to be the first dude in the room with SWAT with a mm-hmm. dog, mm-hmm. which is another step up. Like that's another thing that's really great for MPs to do. And he did all these things. He was fast as fuck. He was always constantly one of the top five or six PT standard guys. He's the kind of dude that I wish would have stayed in the Marine Corps, but now he's doing great things with the NYPD and mm-hmm. like him being their first responder. Having the wherewithal to know what to identify because he has so much experience with bombs by being a bomb dog, explosive dog handler in the Marine Corps. It's a great asset for the NYP to have, and I'm super proud of him. So, Anthony, if you're listening, hit me up, my man. I'm going to get your phone number. We're going to get you on the show, period. You're going to do it even if I have to drag your ass in because I'm still your company gunny. Don't forget that shit. You'll still come on the show. He's a great man. So shout out to Anthony. I'm really proud of him.
Yeah, no, that was, I mean, we can't say enough about those guys when anything like that happens, and especially in such a confined space, for those guys to react the way that they did and really step up and do their job to their fullest. Because I think, and I'm speculating here, but as a police officer, you train, and I guess it's the same for the military. You don't know when something's going to happen, and we've said so many times on this show, you don't really know how you might react until you're put into a situation. So for those guys to have quality training through the NYPD and then to react efficiently, effectively, quickly, the way that they did, really is admirable. And shout out to your guy. We'll give you a little credit, Chaps. You must have trained him up pretty well.
No, I deserve zero credit for that at all. And because Keith K. Marco, the EIC of Barstool, he wanted me to write about it. I was like, look, I don't want to write about it because I don't want to make it about like people think that I'm making about me. Keith wrote the blog and he did a great job of mm-hmm. saying what those guys did. So it was pretty incredible. Earlier this week, did you see about the train
mm-hmm.
derailing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there is also a soldier. We'll give some shout outs to a soldier who was a first responder that was there. So the first responder, he wasn't even on the train, but he was a little bit away from the train whenever it happened. His name is Second Lieutenant Robert McCoy. He's an Army medic assigned to the 56th Multifunctional Medical Battalion, 62nd Medical Brigade at Joint Base Lewis McChord, which is just a few miles southwest of Tacoma, Washington. Mm-hmm. He was on Interstate 5 when he saw the train fall from the overpass. So this is the way that it's going to read out is going to be an award citation for him.
Absolutely.
Eventually, without question. So the train is going south and I'm kind of just driving, McCoy says. And he says, I hear a loud noise and I look up and I see the train has hit a concrete wall on the side. And when it hits the wall kind of exploded and the train just falls off. So he uses his training as a medical officer to get out, immediately start giving self-aid. He has the wherewithal to get out of his truck because he's a medic, an officer assigned with a medic unit. He has tourniquets. He has medical aid stuff in his car. He gets out and starts giving basically combat-style aid. And he's the first one there. How fortunate it is, because there's the three deaths. It could have been much more if he wasn't there and being able to identify people who needed help.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's another scene.
I think that's
another scene. It's like almost like out of a movie. Like, you don't expect to see a train derail in front of you. That doesn't happen, obviously, in everyday life. So for him to react that way and not even hesitate, it sounds like, is quite admirable.
Yeah, he said, at first, I didn't know how stable the situation was. I didn't know if the train would even follow me. But he said, I felt like deep down inside I needed to go check on these individuals. So he started pulling survivors out of the area where if the train would fall, it would fall on people. And it did fall. Like, you saw that it mm-hmm. did fall. Mm-hmm. So it could have crushed a lot more people. He said he saw other people standing by were paralyzed with fear. And I don't blame them at all. I couldn't afford to be scared. I couldn't afford to be shocked. I had to do what I was called to do and focus on that channel and help these people, get them to safety. Whenever we talk about, I've mentioned it so many times, that courage isn't the absence of fear, but it's moving forward despite fear. I think that's it. And I think that there's some people have that innate ability to do that. I don't shit on people who don't have that innate ability, but I do laud those who do. And this second lieutenant definitely had that innate ability. I'm glad that he's a soldier. I'm glad that he's going to be leading soldiers. As just a second lieutenant, to have the wherewithal, the natural ability to step forward, recognize a traumatic event, traumatic experience, and moving forward. Same thing with Anthony Merdini. Same thing. Seeing a bomb on somebody that's rigged to explode, and you know, especially with him being a Marine, he's probably seen mm-hmm. those situations of people use suicide bombers to blow themselves up. Moving forward despite fear, because he knows whenever you're approaching those people, you know that there's a good chance once they see a uniformed law enforcement officer, you're a target at that mm-hmm. point. You are 100% a target.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that would incite the terrorist to potentially act even further. And I think it's important to note about the second lieutenant in Washington. As a second lieutenant, you know, for those who don't know, you're very much brand new to the military. So for him, to have that training, luckily his training was probably very fresh. But to say to yourself, all right, I'm going to do something here and I'm going to help, especially when you see a train, if you've seen the pictures, the train is dangling off of a bridge. That didn't look stable at all. So for him to run in there and say, I need to help, is quite heroic and very... very, very impressive.
For our non-military listeners, to be a first lieutenant, it's a time thing. Like mm-hmm. So you have like the elevation from captain to major, like we've talked about before. The elevation of captain to major is more merit-based than mm-hmm. time-based. Mm-hmm. The elevation from second lieutenant to first lieutenant oftentimes is strictly time-based. There's a little bit of merit in there too, but it's strictly time-based. Like mm-hmm. If you do what you're supposed to do, 2 years later, you're going to be a first lieutenant.
Right.
Typically, 3 years later after that, 2 or 3 years later after that, you're going to be a captain. Captain has some merit to it where you can get it faster than if you're doing really good things
right.
and slower if you're not doing as well. But definitely, second lieutenant to first lieutenant is time-based. So this guy has been in less than 2 years, and he hasn't even been in a unit that long as a second lieutenant because he had to go through basic, mm-hmm. he had to go through his job specialty school. And here he is, just having the natural ability to observe something traumatic, a horrific event, and take action. So credit to him. Mm-hmm. Credit to the Army. Credit to the Marine Corps. Also, we'll give a little credit to the Navy and the Air Force, I guess, too, today. There we go. One of our guests that we're going to have on in a few minutes, that's going to be brought to you by, our guest today is going to be brought to you by our friends at SeatGeek. SeatGeek is taking over the world because they are the best place to buy seats. I've used it several times just over the holiday season. It's the best place that if you want to buy tickets to go to. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere with just a few taps. I can instantly find seats. I actually just used SeatGeek to buy our tickets to the Army and Navy game. That's where we got them from. We had great tickets because they do it where if you press a little button, then it gives you the best value, and the best value is always the way to go. Best of all, our listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Download it today. Enter the promo code CHAPS, and you'll get $10 off your first purchase. It's a no-brainer to do it. Go watch some games. If you're out in San Francisco, watch my beloved Jaguars. Having New Year's or Christmas Day games kind of stinks because you have to get out of something with your family. Like, the kick is 4, and we have church at, like, 7:30 that night. I have to miss the last part of it. Thanks, man. Nah. And you have no choice. As a dad, you can't be like, well, I'll stay home. Because sometimes
you got to set the example.
Like, but Christmas Eve, you got to go.
Right, yeah. And we're big Christmas Eve. We always go to Mass with my family on Christmas Eve. So that will stink a little bit to just pull yourself off the couch. But such as
and wearing
such
a nice sweater is always fun.
Oh, absolutely.
A new nice sweater is always fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have a dude, speaking of being able to go from one end to the other, we have a guy who's coming on as a guest, 8 years as a soldier, and then he went back to Afghanistan as a journalist. So I'm looking forward to hearing that story. We'll go ahead and start that now.
Well, now on Zero Block 30, I'd like to welcome my friend Marty Scovland. Marty just got back from Afghanistan, so he has dirt on the ground, probably still dirt fucking everywhere, actually. If he's anything like me, whenever I would come back from deployments, you can't get the sand, the moon dust, anything away from your stuff for like months. He got back 3 weeks ago. How is life adjusting back for you, Ben, Marty?
Good. Yeah, it wasn't a long, away for too long, but overall, really good trip. Glad to have been able to make it back for Thanksgiving and all that sort of stuff. I'm at that stage in my life where it's not as easy to miss holidays as it was back when I was in the military.
No doubt. Let's talk about your military career a little bit so people get your background. What did you were in the Army for damn near 10 years, right?
Yeah, 8 years. Just shy of 5 years in 1st Ranger Battalion. I did about 5 deployments while I was there. And when I say 5 deployments, I make sure to always, give that caveat of they weren't year-long or 18-month deployments like a lot of the Army did. They were 3 to 4 month deployments. But 3 trips to Iraq, 2 to Afghanistan. And then I got married and did 3 years as a recruiter towards the tail end there.
So you're with – what Ranger Battalion were you with?
1st Ranger Battalion.
Okay, so you were
out of Savannah, Georgia.
There we go. Savannah, Georgia guy. I'm a Jaguars fan, so pretty close to us down there in
Duval. Yeah, not bad at all.
So as you did your time as a Ranger, what were some of the things that really stuck out to you on those deployments to Afghanistan?
I think I deployed to Afghanistan twice, and I think they were two very distinct different deployments because the first one was in early 2007, while the surge in Iraq was still very much the thing that was popping. Afghanistan was kind of this afterthought. A lot of guys in Ranger Battalion actually looked at it as kind of this pseudo training deployment, like going to South Korea or something like that, not a real combat deployment. Of course, we did combat missions, don't get me wrong, but you weren't going out 2-3 times a night like you were in Iraq. And then when I went back in the winter of 2009, it was a completely different war. That was when we were ramping up for the surge. They were in the process of sending over 100,000 people to that country. It just was a completely different environment. And that was really busy. That 2009 deployment was really busy. I distinctly remember, the night before we left, part of our company had already gone over before us. And it was the first time on a deployment where our ADVON element took KIAs before all of us were even over there. And so that kind of set the tone for the entire deployment of like, okay, this is a no kidding sort of situation. Not that war ever is, but it definitely set the tone. It set the tone.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting distinction that we've never really talked about on the show is whenever you, in 2007, I remember when some of the women would get deployment orders to Afghanistan, you'd be like, fuck, man. Like, I actually wanted to go to war. And then it switched. Like, it switched in 2009, 2010, where if you weren't going to Afghanistan, you weren't doing shit. It's kind of strange how the military, and now it's like, okay, I can go to Afghanistan or I could be in Syria. Maybe I'll go fight al-Shabaab. You never know where you're going, but how the military members think about what theater they're in is pretty important, really, for the mindset of what you're going to do while you're there.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I never forget, like, I was the deployment that I did right before that last one that I did in Afghanistan, I was in Iraq when the SOFA was signed, when that Status of Forces Agreement signed that, you know, pretty much effectively ended combat operations in Iraq. And I saw that distinct night to day, you know, shift in Iraq. And then the very next deployment was Afghanistan in a completely different. It was almost like, okay, the party's over in Iraq. So, you know, it was like we were still drunk on combat and looking for the after party, you know, and it was like, oh, well, we got Afghanistan popping over there, you know, just on the other side of Iran. Let's go see what's going on over there. And then we saw the highest casualties of the war, you know, in 2010 once we made that shift.
And that's even bizarre because it's 7 years after the fact that the war even started. Like, you're talking about the highest numbers of combat deaths 7 years after a conflict begins is just a wild concept to even have. Yeah, I think that's a distinction that not a whole lot of people talk about, is that whenever you were in combat situations in 2007 and you really wanted to go to Iraq versus going to Afghanistan because you felt like that was the real Wild West. And I think operators, whether you're an Army guy, whether you're a Marine, whether you're a sailor or Air Force, you always wanted to be where the Wild West was. Iraq was considered that in 2007. Then it switched in 2009 where it just switched back, where Afghanistan was the hot spot and Iraq was like, things are kind of dying down in Iraq. Did you get the same feeling?
Yeah, you know, for me, I was in Iraq when they signed that Status of Forces Agreement, and it effectively ended all the combat in Iraq when that happened. And it was like this very palpable switch between, like, okay, the party's over in Iraq, we're looking for the after party, and that was Afghanistan. And it was such a strange thing to witness and be there for. And, you know, that very next trip going back to Afghanistan, it was like, this is an actual war now. This isn't, you know, there's hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of conventional troops here and, you know, convoys going out like we saw in Iraq and all the, you know, accoutrements of an actual war that we just didn't see in Afghanistan before.
Yeah. And I think it's, you get a little bit of the effect kind of whenever, I don't know, obviously with you being away for 8 years, being in the Army and then now doing what you're doing, you've gone away from home, I assume. And whenever I went away from home, I was from Pensacola, Florida. I lived in Cantonment. And Cantonment was a really tiny, small town. And whenever I came back after spending 5 years in Japan, the town had completely changed. There was new McDonald's up everywhere. There was Target. There was Walmart. Like, all these different things popped up. I think we get a little bit of that feeling whenever we see combat zones. Like, now when I see pictures of what Fallujah looks like now, or when I left 2007, when my Marines would go in 2009 and bring back pictures of the same place, I'm like, that doesn't even look the same. And as service members, we have these time stamps in our head of what it looks like. So I assume when people go to Fallujah is exactly the same way that I left it. Afghanistan is the same way that you left it. But leaving as a military service member on active duty and going back to journalism, I imagine that's what it's like, that there's a huge shift in focus. Can you kind of tell us what the difference was for you being a journalist vice being a service member?
Yeah, man, there's a lot of things that can go into that. But I'll tell you, the real wake-up call came when I landed at, you know, Hamid Karzai Airport. You know, every time I deployed, it was you flew in on a C-17 to a military FOB and you're already right there on a protected base, right? And, you know, coming in this time, it was, I flew in on an Emirates flight into a civilian airport, and it was like, well, I got to hop on one of these little Afghan buses to get over to parking lot C and hail a taxi cab in the middle of the day. Like, and everything inside of you is going like, I'm outside, you know, quote unquote, the wire right now with no helmet on, no kit on, no rifle, anything like that. It's everything in you makes it feel like you went AWOL off of a military base or something.
Feeling like but you're feeling like the good version of Bo Bergdahl just out in the middle of Afghanistan.
Yeah, it was so weird. And then here I am taking a taxi ride across, literally across Kabul, over to, you know, Resolute Support headquarters, and just chatting it up with this kid that's driving the taxi. And it's, you know, you kind of put it all in perspective of, man, and especially what I did in the military was not hearts and minds. You know, we were very much an offensive direct action force. So my only interaction with Afghans up to, you know, this trip had really been
at gunpoint, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like I was very much in control of the situation, and, you know, you're always in very aggressive situations. Whereas now it's like, no, I'm in somebody else's country. And one, I need to behave myself. Two, I'm a guest of this country. I'm not here on behalf of the U.S. military. I am, you know, I had to get an Afghan visa and everything, you know, and I'm depending on this local Afghan to get me to where I need to go. You know, it just was a complete shift in mindset.
I can't even imagine, because you, I mean, whenever I think about looking back at time, like thinking that this is where people live. And so it's hard, like, you don't, I don't want to come off like I'm sympathetic for a lot of the, like, the insurgency. I'm not. I think that there's a huge difference between somebody who is an insurgent and who is planting IEDs, vice the family who is still trying to farm their area or who's still going to work at their tech shop every single week. I think that we have to think about those people, the normal human beings, and put that into our minds, because I think that as Americans, because we've been at war with these areas for so long, we just assume that everybody's there that's bad, and that's not the case at all.
No, I mean, people got to remember there's 15 million more people in Afghanistan today than there was when we invaded. You know, that's 15 million people that, like the population has almost doubled since we invaded. Not everybody there is a bad person. Not everybody there is sympathetic toward the Taliban. Most people, I'm a firm believer, there's like three things everybody wants out of life. They want to fall in love. They want to put food on their table, and they want to put a roof over their head. Like, that's what most people in Afghanistan are trying to do. But they got to deal with this war thing that's going on all around them.
And it's a pretty big thing. I mean, it's been going on for a long time. Kind of walk us through why. You say that you're cautiously optimistic about our efforts in Afghanistan. Why is that?
So the last time I was there, the military strategy just didn't make sense to me. Afghanistan, since we started it, was an unconventional war. We were very successful in the beginning with just sending a couple of special forces ODAs in there who came in on horseback, made alliances with, you know, the local resistance, basically. And they essentially toppled the Taliban. I mean, it's very well documented that the Taliban, by the summer of 2002, had all fled into Pakistan. And, you know, of course, that's a problem with them coming back and forth across the border, and has been ever since then. But we were very successful in those early days by keeping a very small footprint and not having a fire team on every freaking neighborhood corner, you know, throughout the entire country. For a country that for millennia has been repelling outsiders, that just putting people on every road, on every street corner, was never going to work. And I, you know, if I would have went back over there and saw, you know, combat convoys rolling out the gate every 5 minutes, like it used, like that used to be the case, you know, I would have a very different story to report coming back. But that wasn't the case. It seems like they're going towards that. Hey, the Afghans need to fight their own war against the Taliban. We're going to enable them to fight that war. Americans pretty much aren't going outside the wire, with the exception of a couple of special forces advisors who are advising some of the commando units. And that's literally what they're trained to do. And I think that's okay. And we're targeting the you know, the way the Taliban finances itself, which is through narcotics. That all makes sense to me. And why, the reason I say I'm cautiously optimistic is because you can have a military strategy that makes sense and is good and all that, but if you don't take care of all the other pieces of the puzzle, it doesn't matter. We saw that in Vietnam. We never lost a battle, but we didn't have the whole strategy there. In Afghanistan, the economy is not keeping up with the pace of population swell, and all you're doing is feeding the Taliban's force generation model when you don't pay attention to that.
I wanted to get a little bit more into how that they're financing, the Taliban is financing their war. Can you explain what's going on with the opium trade?
Yeah, so Afghanistan right now supplies anywhere between, I've seen estimates between 85% and 90% of the world's opium, which is, of course, the base substance for creating heroin. And opium, the U.S. is the world's largest consumer of opium. And that is pretty much how the Taliban is funding their insurgency is off the sales and exports of that. They're not the same Taliban that they were when the Twin Towers fell. You know, back then they were religious fundamentalists. Now I think they pretty much use that as kind of a recruiting tool to motivate young kids to come join. And but now they're pretty much a narco-funded insurgency. It's not too unlike what we see with the cartel or you know, in our fight in Colombia. Colombia is one of those places we can say we successfully fought a narco-funded insurgency. And that kind of leads me into some of those broader points of, hey, we have a free trade agreement with Colombia that took away the economic power of the cartels down there. We don't have that in Afghanistan right now.
Which is quite the shift. I mean, to go from what the Taliban enforce as far as like enforced morality, religious related morality, to being a narco, I mean, is just unbelievable shift in 15 years. It's pretty wild to even wrap your head around what they're doing. While we've been in the last in the political climate over the last year, we've talked so much about Russia and their influence with our elections, with their influence of everything that's going on in politics. Talk to us a little bit about Russia's influence with Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's any secret at this point that Afghanistan is trying to bolster their position on the world stage and, you know, seeking out influence and trying to coerce nations in any place that they can. They pretty much run the show in Syria right now. We've seen them go into Crimea. We've seen them go into Georgia not only 10 years ago. You know, they're making their intentions pretty clear. And every general that I sat down to talk with in Afghanistan talked about how the biggest issue that they have right now is the fact that the Taliban keeps getting supported by external enablers, namely Russia, Iran, and Pakistan. And Russia obviously being the biggest threat of all of them because they have the most resources. They're supplying weapons. They're supplying night vision devices. I'm sure they're helping out with funds to a certain degree. And these are all things that the generals talk about. General Nicholson talked about it explicitly in his testimony to Congress, as well as there's a lot of other journalists out there that have done really great deep dives into exactly how involved Russia is in Afghanistan. And it's pretty startling, you know.
Without question. I think from when I was there in 2007, when I was in Iraq in 2007, and thinking about the enemy having stuff like night vision goggles just blows my mind, because we win at night. I mean, our being one of the strongest militaries in the world, our biggest advantage is at night, because we have night vision goggles, we have thermal vision goggles, we can see everything. When the enemy has that as well, and they know the terrain much better than we do, it kind of shifts the advantage that we have on the ground whenever you're fighting. I mean, we still have superior weapons, but them having night vision goggles really hurts our guys on the ground. So those type of things make it really dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for U.S. forces, the very limited, you know, few that are going outside the wire on these missions, you know, I won't go into the details, obviously, but from what I was told while I was over there, they're shifting their TTP, their tactics, techniques, and procedures on how to deal with the fact that the enemy also has night vision now. And they're mitigating that to a certain degree, but it certainly doesn't make going out on these missions any easier.
And the ability to get, we've seen videos of more so ISIS than the Taliban, but the ability to have drones that drop IEDs on people too, that's incredibly scary, because we own the sky. In every single conflict that we've been in for the last 30 years, we've owned the sky completely. And having them, even having to look up in the fear of something besides a mortar dropping on your head is scary. I mean, that's a scary, scary concept that they have. Essentially drones that they could buy from Amazon.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing with all of that is, you know, that's the reason the commandos and everything like that are doing the, you know, it's something like 70% of combat operations in Afghanistan right now. But the police and the regular ANA, you know, those guys, they don't have night vision to counter as well. They don't have the better rifles and stuff like you're seeing from some of these Taliban red units, which is like their version of you know, special forces or something. They don't have that stuff. So when you see, you're seeing entire checkpoints just get completely wiped out by some of these Taliban units, because they just, there's no way to outfit every soldier in the ANA with this type of equipment. It's just not feasible. Even in the United States military for the longest time, not everybody had night vision. It was like your squad leader had it. So it's a very challenging environment for them to work in. But fortunately for the Afghans doing the majority of the fighting, they do know the land better than us. They do know all the nooks and crannies. That does help to a certain degree, I think. And they speak the language, which, you know, goes a long ways as far as winning hearts and minds, so to speak.
Definitely. It shows that their culture is important as well, not just yours. I think when you go in there and you, even just an interpreter in every single unit really goes a long way. But when you're just trying to point and shit, it doesn't look like you're 15 years later. Like, come on, dude, like have some people that actually speak the real language of the people that are there. And you do great work on task and task and purpose. You told some personal stories from your time on the ground that go a little bit beyond the story. Can you share that with our listeners as well?
Yeah, it's so there was one commando that I talked with who this guy's just out manning a guard post on the perimeter of Camp Commando. We went up, talked to him, took some pictures and everything. This guy's got an incredible story. He's been a commando for, it's like 7 or 8 years now, in the ANA for 10. He's been in more battles than he can count. Like not missions, but like actual battles.
Right.
Back when Fob Salerno was attacked, just a couple of months after I left on my last deployment, there's this really brazen attack that happened. He was one of the guys that responded to it, got injured in that fight. And this is a guy who he's out there and, you know, he's still happy to be a commando, happy to be out there bringing the fight to the enemy. And he pretty much has this attitude of, well, yeah, I've been hurt before and I've killed a lot of Taliban, but, you know, I'm going to keep doing this until either I'm dead or they're dead, one of the two. And it just is, you sit there and talk to somebody like that, and it's like, man, there's a lot of us, especially within the veteran community, who might think we're hard or something because we went and spent a couple of months in Iraq or Afghanistan or a year. It's like, man, you talk to some of these guys, they don't go home. I mean, this is their home. And it's just incredible to see that 1,000-yard stare on an Afghan commando. Just really, really incredible. I also spoke with one of the colonels in charge of commandos, and this guy had his wife's leg blown off because he's a colonel. He's targeted for assassination. Mm-hmm. His wife's leg was blown off in her backyard hanging up laundry by an IED they planted. His son was almost killed. He's been shot like 4 times during assassination attempts, and he's still going to work every day. It's like these people, they don't live on the base. They live in Kabul.
Right.
You know, like it's just incredible what some of these folks are dealing with and still remaining, you know, motivated to go out and fight the enemy.
No, I think that's a great point because when we talk about people getting green cards and needing the access to come, some of those people who are the interpreters for U.S. military units, some of the things that they went through is unimaginable in 10 years of conflict. And some of them, legit 10 years, like you said, they don't even go home. Or they do go home and it's a city that they're operating in and rounding up the bad guys. Just unbelievable courage that we can't, as an American, I can't even process what that must be like. It's unbelievable. Anything else that you wanted to add from your time? Anything that you can plug for yourself? We want to check out more of your work. I'm sure you have the stories for a book, or your work with Task and Purpose is awesome. Yeah. I look forward to reading more of that.
Yeah, I've got another long form article that'll be coming out specifically on the commandos, but definitely encourage people to check out the current one that really gives the overall strategy and where we're sitting now, 17 years into this war. So definitely encourage people to check that out. And thank you for having me on.
Thank you for your service, Marty, and thank you for what you're doing as a journalist, shedding light on these issues that are going on. Because without journalists on the ground like Marty, we don't know shit about what's happening. We just know what's tweeted out by various governments. So I'd rather have a dude like Marty, who's been a gunslinger, telling us what's actually going on.
One of the best things about coming back from a place like Afghanistan is looking good in civilian attire again. You can look good in your civilian attire with our friends at 5-4. If you've been a stoolie for a long time, you know all about the 5-4 Club. 5-4 Club has revolutionized the way that men shop. Each month, they will send you a curated package of clothes that are handpicked to match. Last year, I remember last year specifically, getting this green and black flannel shirt. Mm-hmm. My friends, the flannel shirt had pockets.
Just I remember
the flannel
that
shirt having pockets. That shirt was a great shirt. I'm going to have to bring that out. That might be my Christmas Eve shirt.
Mm.
I love that flannel. And I would have never had it without 5-4 Club. They know what they're doing at 5-4 Club. So if you don't ask, if you don't know, that's okay. 5-4 will help you build your wardrobe 1 month at a time. You can pause or cancel at any time. Go to 5-4.com right now and enter the promo code 0BLOG19, and they'll give you $40 off your first month purchase. That's an insane deal. That's $40 off your first 5-4 Club. That's IVEFOUR club.com, promo code 0blog1954 club.com, promo code 0blog19. Throw out the stigma, be well dressed. You're going to get some Christmas money, most likely. Use it to dress good, look good. Be a fancy boy like Connor. Get 54club.com gear. Promo code 0block30 or 0block19. 0block19. All right. Indy Save Rounds alibis.
Yeah. We have to mention, you know, when we have guests on this show, I feel like they're then part of the platoon, right? So when you see your guys or your girls doing good things, it gets you jazzed up. And we had two of our guys this week do great things. First, we had Kyle Carpenter, Medal of Honor recipient, graduate from the University of South Carolina. And what was great was when his name was called, there was a standing ovation for him, which he was humbled by, if you read the article about. And that's just awesome for him to serve his country, go through what he went through, be awarded the Medal of Honor, and then go get a college degree is fantastic, because so many soldiers, Marines, they come home and they kind of lose some direction. So for him to have the internal fortitude to go and get a college degree, very proud of him. And then we had our guy, Ali Villanueva, who was elected to be a starter in the Pro Bowl. So to be not only in the NFL, but then one of the best people, if not the best person at your position, to be a starter for the AFC in the Pro Bowl is really something. So really proud of Ali as well. So what a week for the ZBT platoon. Just awesome.
Yeah, man. I have a fun fact for you.
I want to hear it. Please tell me.
Ali is the first West Point graduate to be elected to the Pro Bowl since 1963.
Mm.
That's a good fun fact, right?
It is a good fun fact. I did see that this week, and we couldn't be more thrilled. And obviously, Army's playing tomorrow in our bowl game against San Diego State. We'll see how that goes. San Diego State's got a great team, so it's going to be a challenge. But just, you know, we're definitely happy to be there. And then obviously we got Christmas, and I'm excited for Christmas. Merry Christmas to everyone. I'm very much
we're saying it again.
We're saying it. I never stopped saying it. Did you ever stop saying it?
I don't think a majority of people did. I think that's the weird part about saying that we're saying it again. I think a lot of people still said yeah. Merry Christmas.
Like, well, I never really stopped. But you know when you know
I don't think most people did.
When you have Christmas, you kind of obviously signals the end of the year, and you kind of take stock. And chaps, I just want to say thank you, because this was our first full year, calendar year, start to finish.
First full year.
So, you know, that was a lot of fun. We had a lot of great guests, good trips, great conversations, and great feedback from our listeners and the platoon. And it really just was fantastic, and I'm very grateful for that. So, chaps, thank you very much, buddy.
Yeah, man. I had a great year, too, and I just want to say that if you want to have a great year, you should probably use MyBookie. MyBookie is the place that you want to bet if you want to win some money during the holiday season, because there's a lot of bowl games coming on. You need some distraction from your family because they're going to drive you nuts. Bowl season is in full effect. If you're going to bet, you might as well do it with MyBookie. MyBookie will match your deposit with a 50% bonus. Use the promo code 0 to activate the offer. MyBookie.ag today. You win, you paid. You get paid. Use your holiday cash to make more cash. Cash on cash on cash. Use a little betting version of a Ponzi scheme. Bet on my Jaguars. They're killing against the spread. Bet against the Celtics. Our bet for the Celtics spread. I saw that they were 21-9-2 against the spread this year, which is pretty good. Like, if you're a betting person. My save round alibis is I appreciate you guys. I appreciate all the listeners that tune in each and every week. Connor and Brendan, you guys are both doing a great job. And obviously, Cons, I couldn't do the show without you. You're awesome, man. And to take time out of your big boy job to come in every single week and be a dedicated co-host to me, I really appreciate that. Even though I yelled at you earlier, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was
you know
ugly
what?
About you chewing gum.
Sometimes an officer needs to get put in his place by one of his NCOs. So, you know, I'm grateful that you still have that innate ability
and
to do that.
I'm not averse. I'm not averse to being the one to do that.
Exactly. I need it in my life. So I'm thankful for you that you're willing to do that to me.
Yeah, man. big things coming this year. I'm looking forward to another great year with Zero Block 30. Next week, we're going to have a recap of some of our favorite interviews. So if you, what interviews do you want to hear again with a fresh take on? Because I'll do a little bit of commentary before we actually kick those out. I'm kind of leaning towards having Stanley Rubin again, because that one was a great one. We've gained a lot of listeners since we have Stanley Rubin. That might be the one that we go back and do a little re-listen to, because Stanley's story is great. We're going to introduce a new segment next year where we are going to do first-person narrative stories about different veterans who've come through life and who have passed that we didn't have the opportunity to interview, like Chesty Pooler, John Bassalone, probably Audie Murphy would be one for cons, where we can tell the stories from a first-person perspective, because you can read about it, but we want to share the story in a first-person perspective. Might sound kind of weird, but I think it's going to be a really cool concept that we're going to interview and do like once a month. I also want to give a shout-out to Starbucks. ZBT is going to be doing some work with Starbucks. They sent me, I mentioned to Tao, one of the dudes who works for Starbucks, a few months ago. I mentioned that San Antonio has one of the highest populations of homeless veterans in the country. And I told him that, and that my family and I, we make homeless packages for people who are on the streets that we see. And I keep them in my truck. My wife keeps them in our car. And whenever we go up to somebody who is homeless and we see them at like the intersection or something, we hand them a packet. It has like peanut butter cookies in it. It has ramen. It has coffees. And Tal and the group at Starbucks sent down 200 gift cards of $20 to put in these packages that we're going to deliver to homeless people over the course of the holidays. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. Shout out to Starbucks for helping us give that, because whenever you're standing on the side of the corner, if you can just get a little bit of warm coffee in your blood, I think that helps. That's not a paid ad by Starbucks. They're just doing great things. I'm looking forward to partnering with them in the May time period.
Absolutely.
That's it. Down the If you could do nice things for nice people, always do them. Even if they're not nice people, if you could do nice things, do them. If I can call you to do anything as our listeners throughout the holiday break, take a little bit of time in the many days that you'll have off and try to do something nice for somebody.
Yeah, it goes a long way.
Give back a little. It does. It's on the retreat.